This is Lecture 7 in the Biodiversity Unit, Fungi, an Unappreciated Kingdom. So we'll start by talking about fungi nutrition. Fungi are heterotrophs with absorptive nutrition. What this means is that food is actually digested outside its body. And what they do is they will dump powerful digestive enzymes on whatever material they need to digest. These digestive enzymes will break down the complex organic molecules to simpler compounds. And then these simpler compounds are absorbed through the cell wall and the cell membrane. Fungi have three different lifestyles. The first lifestyle is saprobic. And we've already talked about this in a previous lecture. And what they do is they absorb nutrients from non-living organic material. In other words, dead plants and animals, etc. So maybe you've seen saprobic fungi in your refrigerator. Maybe someone left some food and it got stuck in the back of your refrigerator. And a month or two later, someone found it and there was all this mold and fungi growing on it. That would be an example of saprobic fungi. Now, perhaps your mother and father like to keep the refrigerator really clean and you've never seen this. You will have an opportunity, however, when you go to college. I guarantee that you will see saprobic fungi in your refrigerator. The second lifestyle is parasitic. And in this lifestyle, the fungi will absorb nutrients from the cells of living hosts. Examples of this might be athlete's foot, yeast infections, etc. Perhaps some of you have parasitic fungi living on you right now. Okay, who knows? Finally, the third lifestyle is called mutualism or mutualistic fungi. And they absorb nutrients from a host organism, which in some way they help one another. And the two examples of this that I'm going to talk about are lichen and mycorrhizae, and I'll discuss them a little bit later in this lecture. So first of all, I want to talk about some general characteristics of fungi. There are some species that are unicellular. The most famous unicellular fungi are yeast, and they actually have been used by humans to do different things. For instance, we use yeast to make alcoholic beverages, right? Yeast will break down starch and sugars and help produce wine and beer, and you know, then you can distill it into hard liquor as well. So we have yeast to thank for that. Also, they are used in baking, in terms of baking bread. They will cause bread to rise because they give off CO2 and the gas causes bread to rise. Most fungi are multicellular, and what they are characterized by is a structure called the hyphae. Can you all say that for me? Hyphae. And these are tubular filaments that make up most fungi, and there's two types of hyphae. The first are called cynocytic. Can you all say that for me? Cynocytic. And it comes from two Greek roots. One is kinos, which was where the cyno part comes from, and it's Greek for common. And then koutos is where the cytic part comes from, and it's Greek for vessel. And so if you put these two together, cynocytic means common vessel. And cynocytic hyphae are rather interesting because they're not divided into separate cells. The nuclei are collected in one big long tube, and so it looks like kind of a funky deal because we've always been taught that all living things are broken up into cells, and each cell has one nucleus. And what you're going to find out this year, time and time again, is that you're going to learn rules in biology, and every rule in biology seems to be broken at some time, somewhere, by something. And here's an example of sort of the broken rule of one nucleus per cell. You have multiple nuclei per cell, and that's why it's called cynocytic, common vessel. In other words, they all these nuclei share a common vessel. And it's the most common form of hyphae. Septate hyphae come from the Latin word for septate, which means wall. And these are hyphae in which they have septa or walls that sort of break up the hyphae. Now, they actually have little holes in this in these walls, so you can still have movement of nuclei and other organelles through them, but they do limit the flow a little bit. So it's not like the cenocytic where it's just a free-for-all where everything's just mixed up. There is some division, but not a perfect division as you think of in terms of a cell. The next slide discusses mycelium. And mycelium is interesting. It's a large collection or network of hyphae. And this collection of hyphae, which is called a mycelium, can form actual visible structures of a fungus. And so if you see a mushroom, the mushroom is a classic example, and you see in this picture I have that the what you think of as a mushroom is really a collection of hyphae that form the stalk and then the cap of the mushroom. And you probably never even really knew that. And in fact, if you look at a mushroom growing in nature, underneath the ground, the hyphae extend as well, and they form a network, and which seems similar to what might be a root in a plant. But remember, this is a fungi, not a plant. And so really, fungi are funny because they almost kind of look like a plant. They're not green, but they have sort of a, I guess you could think of it as a trunk, and then in this case of a mushroom, a little cap, which would sort of be the upper structure of a plant. And then it's got this sort of root-like structure. But really what it is the whole thing is just hyphae all collected together in this network that forms these larger structures. Kind of interesting. The other thing to know about hyphae is that they have cell walls. Fungi is that they have cell walls. And the cell walls are made of a material called chitin. Can you all say that for me? Chitin. By the way, I don't think we pronounce mycelium. Can everyone say mycelium? Very good. So chitin is actually a polysaccharide. It's a sugar. And what's interesting is this chitin is also, the exact same chitin is also found in the exoskeleton of arthropods. And, of course, the most famous arthropods are insects. So the exoskeleton of insects is made out of the same material that the cell walls of fungi are made out of. Chitin. Now let's do a quick review. What are the other two kingdoms that have cell walls? Can someone name one of the kingdoms? Raise your hand. Yes. Yeah, the plant kingdom. And what are the cell walls of plants made out of? Do you remember? Cellulose. Very good. Okay, so that's one of the kingdoms. What's the other kingdom? Can someone tell me what that kingdom is? Yeah. Not protozoa. Protozoa isn't a kingdom, by the way. Yeah. Monera. And what is the cell wall of Monera is made out of? Not sure. Someone. Yes, Andy. Yeah, peptidoglycan. Let's say that again. Peptidoglycan. Good. So just as a quick review, out of the five kingdoms, three kingdoms have cell walls. The plant kingdom, cell walls, cellulose. The fungi, cell walls are made out of chitin, and the monera, the cell walls are made out of peptidoglycan. So there you go. The other two kingdoms do not have cell walls. And that would include, what are the other two kingdoms, by the way? Let's see if we remember. Someone name one of the next kingdoms. Yeah. What's that? Yeah, the animal kingdom, and then what's the other kingdom? We haven't talked about it yet. Yeah. Yeah, protista. Very good. Okay. Symbiosis is found, there are two examples, great examples of symbiosis in fungi. And the specific case is mutualism, is the one I want to talk about. Lichen is actually a mutualistic relationship between algae and fungi. And what happens in this relationship is that the algae have chlorophyll, so they're able to photosynthesize, and they provide the energy. They basically take sunlight and convert the energy of sun, you know, sunlight energy into chemical energy, right? Anybody know what kingdom algae are found in? Does anyone remember? Yeah. Protista, exactly. We haven't even talked about it yet, but that's what kingdom they're in. And then the fungi provide the structure and protection. And so they help each other out. Now, you may have seen lichen if you've gone on a hike recently. Oftentimes on rocks, you'll see kind of a green, crusty-like material. Sometimes it's even yellow or purple or orange. And this is lichen. Also, you will sometimes see lichen growing on the bark of trees or growing actually off branches of trees, and it's usually green in that case. But it's not organism per se. It's actually a mutualistic relationship between two organisms. Yes? No. Ferns are plants. That's an organism within a kingdom. This is a mutualistic relationship between something from the protist kingdom and the fungi kingdom. No. It's a mutualistic relationship between an algae and a fungi. It has to be an algae. In fact, if you've ever been to Walden West, maybe your counselor told you a fun little way to remember what a lichen is. Do you remember? Yep, exactly. Okay, maybe you learned it in bio. Yeah, so remember this for the test on Thursday. Freddy fungi and Alice algae took a lichen to one another, and they lived together in symbiosis. Okay? Isn't that cute? Yeah. Okay. Mycorrhizae. Everyone say mycorrhizae. One more time. Mycorrhizae. And this is a mutualistic relationship between a plant and a fungus. And if we do the breakdown on the word, myco refers to fungus. Rhizae refers to root. So root fungus. And it turns out that this will surprise most of you, I bet. Over 95% of all vascular plants have mycorrhizae. So if you just on your way home today or between classes, you see plants, most every plant you're going to see is going to be a vascular plant. And so most likely there is a mycorrhizae relationship going on where you've got a plant and a fungus interacting. And what happens is the fungus will increase the absorptive surface of the plant roots, and it will also help the plant acquire certain minerals. Super important. The plant, in turn, provides the fungus with food because, once again, it photosynthesizes. It will take sunlight energy and produce sugar, make sugar. And so it's a wonderful relationship. And it's pretty surprising. Now, you would never know this because, you know, you're not a mycologist, a person that studies fungus, but if you actually go and you do the biology, you'll find that most vascular plant roots have some kind of fungus associated with them. And it's a good thing because it's mutualistic. Okay, so that's the end of lecture 7. I want to now go to lecture 8. This is the last lecture in the biodiversity unit. It's lecture 8 called Kingdom Protista, a kingdom for all the leftover organisms. I begin with the question, Kingdom Protista, an artificial group? Well, if a eukaryote is not a fungus, not a plant, not an animal, then what kingdom do we place it in? Well, there's only one kingdom left, Kingdom Protista. And if you actually look at Kingdom Protista, most of them are unicellular. You probably are familiar with Paramecium, amoebas, these organisms. Maybe you looked at them under the microscope in a previous bio class. Some are multicellular, like the brown algae, you know, the giant kelp that we'll see at Catalina Island. that's actually in the Kingdom Protista as well. In fact, it turns out that if you look at all the different kingdoms, it turns out that Protists are more diverse in structure and function than any of the other organisms in the other kingdoms. In fact, the only thing that actually unites all Protists is the fact that they're eukaryotes. Pretty much it. Now, the evidence from the evolutionary history of all living organisms, we call this phylogeny. It shows that Kingdom Protista is actually an artificial group. So I've drawn a picture on the board over there. It looks like a tree. And this was a picture that actually Charles Darwin came up with, and he published in The Origin of Species. And the reason he did is because it's a great metaphor for the history of life. Because if you look at the trunk of the tree right at the base, let's say that represents the origin of life 3.8 billion years ago. And then as time continued, life began to evolve and branch into many, many, many branches. And so at the very top of the tree, that would represent the present time. And along the way, you'll see that some branches don't continue. That would be organisms that went extinct. And then eventually, you know, up at the top, those are all the organisms that are still living. But if you trace them, you can trace their origin phylogenetically all the way back to an original ancestor. And so you might think of that, that's a phylogeny, where you link everything back together, sort of the family history, the evolutionary history of all living organisms. It's very much like a genealogy that you might do for your family, right? Except a genealogy just shows all your relatives. But this shows all your relatives too, but it goes all the way back to the very beginning of life. So a phylogeny, you know, an evolutionary history that you see here, is sort of like a genealogy on steroids, you know, if you want to think of it that way. Okay, so if in the next slide, what you'll see is the evolutionary history of protists. And what you're going to find out is that protists are not what we call a monophyletic group. Can you all say it for me, monophyletic? And so the word mono means one, and phylo refers to tribe or race. And so monophyletic means one tribe or one race. And there is not one common ancestor that's unique to only organisms in Kingdom Protista. And let me contrast that. So if we look at animals, and if you look at my little illustration here, you'll see animals actually have a common ancestor from which all animals evolved. It would be right there, and everything that evolved from that one animal is considered an animal. So animals are monophyletic. If you look at fungi, there is an ancestor to all fungi, and all fungi are therefore monophyletic. They're in one group. They had one ancestor. And if you look at plants, plants had an original ancestor right there, and all plants are therefore monophyletic. But where things get a little more confusing is if you look at protists. Now look at protists, and you'll see that there's a whole bunch of different lines that come up from this main branch, and they all they're all now included in Kingdom Protista. So we say that Kingdom Protista is not monophyletic, it's polyphyletic. What does poly mean? Many. So it has many lines of origin, not one single ancestor. Because even if you went here, let's say down here at the base, and you said, well, there's the ancient ancestor of all protists, and you would say, well, that's good, yeah, because there and there and there and there. But oops, look at animals, fungi, and plant would be included. So protists aren't monophyletic. You can't find just one single origin of all protists. So really, it's not a natural group. It's an artificial group of organisms, and that's my point. So let's look at their nutrition. Some protists are photoautotroph. In other words, they have chloroplasts and they make their own energy. And an example of single-cell organisms that do this are the diatoms. Can everyone say diatoms? Diatoms are found in both marine and freshwater environments, and we're actually going to see these at Catalina Island. We're going to look under the microscope at plankton, and we're going to get a real close look at them. They're very cool to look at under the microscope. There's also multicellular organisms like brown algae, and we're going to see kelp on Catalina Island as well. So we're going to see the extreme of Protista at Catalina. We're going to see single-cell examples of Protista and multicellular huge examples of Protista. And impress the counselors there, the instructors there, by remembering this stuff, and they'll go, ooh, wow, Los Gatos High School. Great students. Okay. Another form of nutrition is, heterotrophic nutrition, and many protists will eat other organisms. A great example is the didenium, which is shown here eating a paramecium. So one protist eating another protist, and there it is finishing off the protist, just sort of almost about to lick its lips. Oh, they don't have lips, but you know what I mean, okay? Also, amoebas, shown here, can use their pseudopodia, their false feet, to capture food and then eat it. Oops. And then, come on. And then the stentor is another organism pictured here, which has cilia that beats and causes organisms to come down and get captured into its gullet and draws food into its gullet. The different ways of eating. Another form of nutrition is called mixotrophs. The word mixo refers to mix, troph refers to food, and these are known as mixed feeders. And these protists can be either autotrophic or heterotrophic. It just depends. They can do both. And euglena is a great example of this. Euglena is green because it's got chlorophyll, therefore it can photosynthesize in the presence of light. However, if it's in the dark, no worries, it can just eat stuff. And so it can be heterotrophic if it's in the dark. So it can go either way. It can be autotrophic or heterotrophic. There are three main ways these single-cell protists can move. One is through pseudopodia, these false feet, and you see a picture of an amoeba moving to the right here. Also, you can have flagella, they're either usually found singular or in pairs, and they undulate back and forth, and they cause this organism pictured here to move to the right. And then the example, of course, is euglena. And then finally, you can have cilia, which are smaller versions of, they're not big like flagella, they're smaller, and they beat back and forth, and by undulating back and forth, they force this organism to move to the right. They're all unicellular, yeah. And what's interesting about cilia and flagella, as you can see in the next slide, is that even though they look very different, ones, flagella are very long and cilia are very short, if you actually look at them internally, you'll see that they're pretty much identical. They're constructed in what's called a 9+2 architecture using microtubules. These microtubules are simply long proteins, and they come in pairs. So there's 9 pairs on the outside here. If you count them, you'll count 9. And then 2 single microtubules in the middle. And so cilia and flagella look identical inside, but they're much different outside. Finally, in the last slide, we're going to see how protists are found in our aquatic ecosystems. It turns out that they have a fairly low species diversity. They actually represent only about 10% of the named eukaryotic species. However, they are highly abundant. And if you take, for instance, a single teaspoon of pond water, it can contain over 1,000 protists. It's amazing. And if you actually look at a food pyramid, which I have illustrated here, you'll notice that the photoautotrophic protists are at the base of the food pyramids, the base of the food chains, in both freshwater and marine environments. So they're super important. They provide the foundation of both freshwater and marine ecosystems. And then the next level up, you'll see heterotrophic protease. And my point here is that without protease, most aquatic ecosystems would collapse. So they're very, very critical in our world.